Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. Well, another year has slipped into history, and with it, some real challenges to religious freedom. Some battles were won, some still rage. But we must never underestimate the power of providence and the never-ending persistence of the Christian heart. I've asked Michael Peabody, a frequent guest of this program and an employment law attorney practicing in Los Angeles, California, to join us today to talk about this past year and some of the issues that surfaced. Michael is also the director of ReligiousLiberty.tv, a website dedicated to what its name implies. Michael, welcome back to Life Quest Liberty.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, 2012, good year, bad year, strange year for religious freedom?
Well, I think it was really kind of a strange year. A lot of good news, a lot of bad news, some in-between news. It was all over the map this year, especially with the election season that took place and some of the court decisions that were rendered. It's going to go down in history as a very significant year as far as religious liberty is concerned, I believe.
Well, let's start from some good news. Do we have some good news from anywhere in the world we should talk about?
Well, some of the best news is the release of Iranian pastor Youssef Nadarkhani. He spent 1,062 days in prison in Iran for apostasy and for evangelization. 35 years old right now. He was imprisoned because he had converted, or he was alleged to have converted, from Islam to Christianity. And in reality, he'd been a Christian most of his life. His parents had been Muslims in the past. And he was sentenced to death by the Iranian judicial system, and only released after significant outcry from around the world in September 2012. So it was great news to see him coming out of prison. There's some great pictures online of that event. And he recently spoke in London at the Christian Solidarity Worldwide National Conference, and he was very grateful to his supporters, and he said he was alive today because of what your prayers did for me. I know that there are several organizations that were working very hard to release him. We were able to send a lot of readers over to those organizations to fill out petitions and to commit themselves to pray for his release. And so this was fantastic news. Although we can't forget that there are many other people still suffering very significant persecution in parts of the world and actually being killed for their beliefs and for doing what he did.
You mention often on this program, Michael, how we need to be involved. And this sounds like a way that we can be involved by simply being aware and reacting to it in our own way. That's exactly what happened with this guy, and he was released because of it.
Right. And, you know, in a sense, he was sort of a poster child for what's been going on. And there are many other stories that never made it to the surface. And I think, you know, if we look at it not only in terms of this one individual, but in terms of what we could be doing in the entire region,
yes,
as far as praying for people, upholding religious liberty as part of our own viewpoint and our own approaches, I think, you know, we can really make a difference in the world.
Well, that is good news indeed. And again, we need to be involved. And one of the best ways of doing that is simply educate ourselves on this program, on ReligiousLiberty.tv website, and of course on LibertyMagazine.org website. These are places where you can go and learn about the things that are happening. When I hear stories like this, I kind of shiver internally because this is what happens. This is what happens when you don't keep the state and the church separate. Am I on the right track here?
I think so. And, you know, in Iran, you have a situation where you have the religious groups sort of dictating to the government what is acceptable and what is not. And then the government then turns around to religious groups and minority religious groups and tells them that what they can do that's acceptable, what they cannot do. In Iran, it was illegal to proselytize or to try to convert people to Christianity or to inform them of Christianity to let them make the decision. And in fact, that conversion itself is a crime, punishable by the death penalty. So there are significant problems when you have church and state together. It's not the purpose of the state to be involved in getting religious doctrine imposed as part of the law. And usually churches or religious organizations aren't going to punish citizens from other religious groups, but the state can do that. And that's what can happen in situations where there's no separation of religion from government. the government ends up carrying out civil punishments for religious infractions. That's happened throughout history.
Well, we can praise God for the little victories that are happening throughout the year. Okay, the Supreme Court. Let's move on. The Supreme Court's been busy this year, as it usually is, and one of the issues that it dealt with has to do with the health of us all. Tell us about that.
Well, on June 28 of last year, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. It's also known as the ACA or Obamacare. And this was a law that actually closely tracked a conservative proposal from the 1980s that said people should buy their own insurance. They shouldn't be taken care of by the state. If they had the opportunity to get insurance, they had the means to get insurance, and they decided not to for whatever reason, the state and the citizens should not be responsible for providing them care. And so what it does is it mandates that people buy health insurance, just like people can be mandated to buy auto insurance or any other type of insurance, in order to kind of protect the public at large from people who would take advantage of the system without contributing to it. The problem with it was that the health care plan would require employers to provide insurance that would cover contraception, abortion medications in some cases, or abortion-inducing drugs, and even sterilization. So there were some very serious religious objections to being required to do that. The administration made a compromise that said that the churches could be exempt from it, but essentially that was a very narrow accommodation and would only apply to actual houses of worship, and there was a question as to whether it would apply to religious educational institutions, hospitals, things like that. So there were several lawsuits that were brought against the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court ultimately upheld the ACA, but the issues of whether or not religious employers will be affected remain up for grabs. Currently, there's a case going forward involving Hobby Lobby, which was a secular company owned by religious people, and the owners object to abortion or to contraception, so they're trying to get exemption because of the owner's personal beliefs. I don't know how far they're going to get with that argument, but it's sort of the direction that the court is looking to make rulings in, and we'll be tracking that throughout the year.
Absolutely. In other words, when we put our funds into this thing called Obamacare, part of Obamacare includes contraceptives and the abortion process. So in other words, we're not choosing that our money be used that way, but our money can be used that way. Am I right on the right track here?
Right. It's just one of the many things that are covered by that.
All right. Okay.
Just like with other insurance plans. And so it's kind of a complex issue. The moral issue involves whether or not a person should be denied things because their secular employer does not believe that they are proper.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't see why we can't put the money in the fund, because we are not saying go have an abortion. When someone has an abortion, it is a choice that they're making to go use those funds in that way. We are not promoting abortion by providing money for this fund. What seems to be the problem?
Well, and, you know, the other example would be simply an employer who pays a person a paycheck, and that person goes and buys something that
right.
the employer would not buy.
Right.
So there's a number of arguments that can be made on that. Ultimately, I think it will be found to apply to everybody, to every organization, aside from some very specific religious organizations that have a very specific religious objection.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on that for sure. Number three in our list for today of the top stories of 2012 when it comes to religious liberty, redefinition of religious liberty in the 2012 election cycle. What is the redefinition of religious liberty according to this election cycle?
Well, the definition of religious liberty that was starting to come out during this election cycle really incorporates the concept of a more active religious base that is active in the activities of the government and sort of where the church presses for laws that meet the goals of the general or the common good based on their understanding of natural law. And those things which they view at variance with the natural order of things would end up being marginalized. Thomas Aquinas actually taught back in there, he's one of the early church founders in the Catholic Church, and he said that there were five principles that the law needed to promote. That was to live, to learn, to reproduce, to worship God, and to live in an ordered society. And religious liberty is sort of being moved from the concept where it is something where everybody has the right to worship God as they choose to this concept that society needs to be ordered along the lines of the common good so that we can achieve these five important principles. And among them, this cycle was the concept that we are, have a natural law instinct to reproduce, and that should not be infringed upon. The Catholic Church actually led much of this charge and during the last election cycle in the contraception debate, and they said that when the government would impose the requirement that employers provide contraceptive coverage, they were interfering with the natural law of requiring the natural law mandate that people reproduce.
Right.
So it's sort of a, the concept where the church can get more involved in government, not in the sense that they're going to force people to follow their religious beliefs, but rather in the sense that they want to promote this idea of natural law, which according to their definition includes these types of mandates by God or by natural human instinct that's discoverable through logic.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a back way of redefining religious liberty to ordering society along a particular concept of how everything works.
Do you think, Michael, in your own heart of hearts, do you think that the government is somehow trying to make inroads into the religious life of people? Sometimes I think that we kind of overreact. We read into things the government does more than we should. It's like we've become paranoid of everything that the government does. Is there an underwriting, undercurrent of attempt here to get hold of the religious beliefs of people and change them to some overriding structure that the government knows about that we don't?
Well, I don't know if there's any type of conspiracy like that, but there is a legitimate concern that there is a secular movement to try to secularize the country and move people away from their religious principles.
But secularize the country. The country is supposed to be a secular country. It was built by secular people on secular principles. Maybe a few divine principles thrown in into the mix, but this is supposed to be a secular country.
Well, I may disagree with you on that because the founders were, in fact, many of them were religious, and they actually approached religious liberty issues from a religious standpoint. But they said that God will influence the conscience of each person, and those people should be able to follow what they believe is God's will. The government shouldn't get between a person and God. So many of the founders, you know, were in fact very religious people.
Yeah.
And in fact, looking at our history, you go to the abolitionist movement, they were religious people. You go to the temperance movement, led by religious people. The civil rights movement was led by religious people.
But these weren't Southern Baptists. When you say religious people, these were not Southern Baptists or Seventh-day Adventists. These were people who had a foundational faith that they were trying to protect. Am I right?
Well, in a sense, they wanted to protect their right to practice their religious beliefs.
There you go. Protect. They want to protect the rights, not mandate the rights.
Right.
Okay.
So it's not like they said, well, we need to remove God from everything. Yeah. That wasn't the concept. The concept was that as part of my devotion to God, I want to be able to worship God in my own way without the government getting in the way.
Okay.
So there's a tight balance between secularism and overt religiosity in a sense, where you have a civil religion where the government will tell you what you need to do religiously, which was what they came away from, and which was the European model when this nation was founded.
Yeah. Our guest today is Michael Peabody. He is the director of ReligiousLiberty.tv. He's also an employment law attorney practicing in Los Angeles, California, and a frequent guest on this program. And today we're talking about what happened in the 2012, what issues came to the front, and what was decided, and what things need to be decided yet. And Michael, let's move on now to this I live next door to Maryland. I live in West Virginia, right next door to Maryland here. And Maryland passed the same-sex marriage. Voters approved it in this last election. Four states have the same approval of same-sex marriage. Are we talking a religious liberty issue here or a civil liberty issue here?
Yeah, that's a very good question because I think a lot of times civil issues have been redefined as religious issues.
Yes, yes.
You know, you look at the issue of abortion, it would probably be a civil issue.
Yeah.
But you look at the issue of human trafficking, which religious people should be interested in,
yes,
but it's viewed in secular terms, and the religious community really hasn't stepped up to the plate on it. So it's kind of a interesting dichotomy. I think it's an issue.
Yeah.
I'm not going to define it as a religious liberty issue or a secular issue. It's just an issue. Same-sex marriage was approved by voters in Maine, Maryland, and Washington. And there was a ballot measure in Minnesota that voters rejected that would have limited marriage to one man and one woman.
Uh-huh.
And North Carolina was the only state where voters actually voted to define marriage as only being between one man and one woman. So there's a major shift that's happened in the last 4 or 5 years when it comes to same-sex marriage. Now we have a situation where California voters in 2008 approved Proposition 8, which was a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, and you have other states where voters actually approved it. So the Supreme Court is going to be looking at the marriage cases. In particular, it's going to determine whether Proposition 8 was constitutional. Can voters revoke the right of same-sex couples to marry? Since it had been approved and then revoked just a few months later. And it's going to need to determine also whether marriages that are performed in a state where it is legal need to be recognized in states where it is illegal.
Hmm.
So there are several ways the court may go. The court may simply leave it up to the states to decide how to handle the issue. The court could uphold same-sex marriage across the country, or the court theoretically could decline to uphold same-sex marriage and actually make it illegal nationwide. Now, that's a very unlikely outcome.
Yeah.
More likely, the court will either uphold gay marriage nationwide or let the states make their own decisions. And there's another case going on with the Supreme Court. Both these cases will be heard in March, decisions in June. The other case is whether or not the court will uphold the Defense of Marriage Act, which prevented same-sex couples from receiving federal benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some serious issues that are coming in front of the court. We've got split jurisdictions on the issue, and it's not likely that we're ever going to return to a place where same-sex marriage is not legally enforced.
Hmm. I'm just curious, Michael, if a state says okay on same-sex marriage and a bunch of people get married, and then they later say, no, we've changed our mind, we don't want same-sex marriage, do those people stop being married at that point? How does that work legally to the people who took advantage of the lifting of a ban before the ban was reimposed?
Well, in this case, the people who were married during that window period are still married, legally in California.
And they still have legal rights that they would have with the ban not in place?
Yeah, they still have the legal rights in California.
Okay.
Interestingly, some of the first couples to get married are now going through same-sex divorces and they're having to deal with community property and all that.
Mercy.
So it's kind of an interesting situation. If we were to take the same-sex issue out of it and just deal with any other constitutional issue, if the state of California had revoked some other constitutional right, maybe free speech or something, I think we'd have a very serious constitutional concern about what the power of the voters is to address a fundamental right.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is a fundamental right to marry who you want to marry, it's going to be interesting to see what other rights that kind of approach could spread to if Proposition 8 is upheld.
Okay. Well, that is an interesting thing. Okay, number 5 on the list you gave me here, U.S. Supreme Court upholds ministerial exception to employment laws. We talked about this in an earlier program in the year. What's happening with that?
Well, in January of last year, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled in the case of Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church versus the EEOC, and the court ruled that the anti-retaliation provision of the Americans with Disabilities Act does not apply to a religious school's termination of a parochial school teacher. Cheryl Parrick was a teacher who was on disability leave, and when she went back to work, they said, well, we don't have a place for you, we're not going to rehire you. And she said, well, if you don't rehire me, I'm going to sue you. The school said, we're a religious school and we have a religious doctrine against you suing us, so therefore you have no right to sue us. The EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, is a federal agency that addresses discrimination claims, and they actually filed a lawsuit against the school on behalf of the teacher. The Supreme Court said that the EEOC was incorrect in that because churches are exempt when it comes to who they hire, and they can be exempt from the provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act when it comes to retaliatory terminations and things like that. It was kind of an egregious scenario that happened. I mean, the poor teacher, she was, you know, if she'd been in any other situation, she would have, you know, won. It's illegal to fire somebody because they threatened to pursue their rights under a federal act, such as the Americans with Disabilities Act. But the court ultimately protected the right of a religious organization to set its own rules. If they had not done that, then this court could come in and say, well, no, you have to hire these people. You can't discriminate on the basis of religion or whatever else. And it would make it much more difficult for religious schools in general or religious churches to make their own employment decisions. So it was a proper decision, although I do feel very badly for the teacher involved.
Absolutely. Well, some of these are very complicated, and if someone's going to get hurt, that's just the way it is with these things. Okay. Michael Peabody is our guest today. We're talking about the top stories of 2012. Federal court rules Oklahoma amendment barring Islamic law was unnecessary and discriminatory. What's the story behind that story?
In 2010, voters in Oklahoma, 70% of the voters actually, voted to approve a state constitutional amendment that barred Islamic law in the state. Now, if you look at the Constitution, if the government cannot establish a state church, the government has separation of church and state. But the voters in Oklahoma perceived a threat to that, and they voted overwhelmingly to bar Islamic law. The problem was that there was no actual threat in place. There was nobody actually calling for Sharia law to be legally binding in Oklahoma. And so a Muslim individual who felt that they were being discriminated against because people were, you know, treating them differently because they were perceived to be trying to do something like that or trying to impose their own beliefs on other people, sued and requested that the law be overturned. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed and overturned the ballot initiative that had barred Islamic law. And the court used a rule called the Larson test that said if a law discriminates between religions, and in this case it specifically identified Islam, it can survive only if it is closely fitted to the furtherance of any compelling state interest. Now, in this case, the Tenth Circuit said that there was no compelling state interest because there was no actual harm that the amendment would remedy. They said that, in fact, that the harm that the amendment would fix was speculative at best and could not even support a compelling interest. So the court made the right decision in overturning that ballot initiative. Obviously, if somebody does try to impose Sharia law in any jurisdiction, there will be all kinds of constitutional problems with that, and those could be brought up separately. But you can't go and bring a law up against a religious group without there being some type of threat in place.
You know, a lot of us listening to this program, and I know from time to time, I think religious liberty is just simply my ability to go to church when I want to and to worship the God I want. But as we're seeing item after item, as we're going through this, religious liberty is a far greater issue, a far greater challenge around the world than just simply whether you can go to church down the street on the day you want to and worship the God you want to and sing the songs you want to. It's far more complicated than that, and I'm so glad that places like ReligiousLiberty.tv and Liberty Magazine and editor Lincoln Steed and Michael Peabody here, I'm glad these people are keeping their finger on the pulse here, and they're sharing these insights with us, so we'll know that it's a whole lot bigger and a whole lot broader than sometimes we think it is. Religious freedom is a vital element, a vital fiber in the fabric of lives around the world. And I really appreciate you guys just keeping your eyes on this stuff and sharing your knowledge on this stuff. California legislature bans gay conversion therapy. What on earth is that?
That's a very interesting situation that's arisen in California. The legislature actually passed a law, SB 1172, banning minors from receiving counseling that would help them change their sexual orientation. A lot of this was from religious organizations would say that being, you know, homosexual is a sin, and so you can go through this therapy that will help change you into a heterosexual. The legislature heard arguments from a number of health therapists that say, well, you're born a certain way and you can't change no matter what you want to do. Therefore, it's harmful if somebody tries to make you change.
Yeah.
They did allow for a religious exception, and they said, well, if your church wants to try to counsel you, somebody's a religious counselor, they can say something. But if they're a licensed therapist, they cannot treat you for that.
Okay.
So it's created a real conflict in California. And there have actually been two suits that were brought forward. One was brought by the Pacific Justice Institute on behalf of three therapists. And in their case, in December, a federal judge granted an injunction against the bill, saying that the bill involved an infringement of free speech and it should be overturned. At the same time, there's another case brought forward by Liberty Counsel on behalf of some people who had actually said they changed their sexual orientation after going through this therapy. And in that case, the judge viewed it as conduct. The judge said that the legislature had grounds to enact that law because multiple health groups had discredited the therapy. So she looked at it, Judge Mueller looked at it from a perspective of being a type of treatment that wasn't proper and that didn't work, whereas Judge Shub had said it was an infringement on free speech. This case is going to go up, and I think it may actually reach the Supreme Court ultimately.
All right. Well, our time has slipped away. We have just about 30 seconds left here. What can you give us about the California legislature passes Workplace Religious Freedom Act? Why is that important to us?
Well, the California legislature this last year voted to actually extend religious accommodation to include the practice of wearing religious clothing and religious hairstyles.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, an employer had to reach a fairly high standard before it could disallow somebody from, you know, taking time off to observe their Sabbath or other religious holy days. And they needed a reasonable time necessary to travel and make preparation for the observance of the holy day. This bill, which is AB 1964, named after Title VII, which was passed in 1964, would also amend this to include religious clothing and religious hairstyles. So it really provides an opportunity for people in the Sikh community to receive religious accommodation. And it's an excellent bill that's actually mirroring a bill that was passed previously in Oregon, and they're going to be working on it in Washington State.
Okay, well, we've taken a look back in the year, and now we know what to look forward to in the coming year. There are still some issues that need to be resolved, and I know that Michael Peabody, editor and creator of ReligiousLiberty.tv, will be on the job making sure that we can learn what we need to learn from these things that happen. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And listener, until next time, this is Charles Mills, along with Michael Peabody, inviting you to rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone. You've been listening to Life Quest Liberty. To further explore the issues discussed on today's program, visit www.libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of religious freedom burning in your heart today.